From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we speak with film director Neil Jordan. In 1986, Jordan co-wrote and directed the critically acclaimed movie Mona Lisa. Now Jordan's made his first big-budget film, the new comedy High Spirits. Also, we speak with the man who's interviewed more people on TV than anyone else, and he has an entry in the Guinness Book of Records to prove it, talk show host Joe Franklin. And we have reviews of two new rock albums from Britain and of a new rock concert movie, U2's Rattle and Hum. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Neil Jordan is one of the most original filmmakers to emerge from Britain in the 1980s. He's best known as the co-writer and director of the 1986 film noir Mona Lisa. It stars Bob Hoskins as a small-time hood who is the driver for a call girl played by Kathy Tyson. The man they both answer to is played by Michael Caine. Jordan is from Ireland, where he first became known for his novels and short stories. The British television station Channel 4 backed his early films, including Danny Boy and The Company of Wolves, which was a series of supernatural tales based on werewolf legends and the Little Red Riding Hood fairy tale. Jordan's first big-budget Hollywood film opens this weekend. High Spirits is a supernatural comedy set in an Irish castle. The castle's owner, played by Peter O'Toole, can't pay the bills, so he tries to make the castle into a haunted house theme park to attract American tourist dollars. Steve Guttenberg and Beverly D'Angelo play a couple who hope a vacation in the castle will help revive their soured marriage. But at the castle, the husband falls in love with Mary, one of the castle's real ghosts, played by Daryl Hannah.
Mary?
Who's Mary?
Who's
this Mary?
She's a woman. She's a ghost.
Oh, just
no, she's
don't
a woman
start
ghost.
This ghost stuff
She's
again.
Someone I care about, and
what?
It's funny how you can care. I think I'm falling.
Jack, don't stand there and tell me that you're having an affair with a goddamn ghost.
Well, I am.
No,
oh, wait
that's
a minute.
It.
You
that's
gotta
it,
give me a chance.
It.
You can't Your just
lawyer,
walk right.
My lawyer, and I hope the ghost has a lawyer because I want to meet him.
You know, the conflict. Here she is. This is Mary.
No, Martin.
This is Mary.
Neil Jordan, welcome to Fresh Air. Your previous movies have all been pretty dark, either film noir or dark supernatural. And your new movie has the opposite mood. It's a supernatural movie where even death is benign. And even when you die, you're still capable of having a good time.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people are incapable of creating both moods, that some people are born to do dark things and other people born to do comedies. You seem to be interested in doing both.
Well, I wanted to make a film that was the most ridiculously happy film that ever happened. You know, it's... people have always said about my films that they need happy endings and, you know, we should change, shouldn't be so dark, and why do they have to die, and, you know, why do the people have to do horrible things to each other? So I thought, well, I thought if I do a comedy, I'll give it the most ludicrously happy ending in the world, where people not only die, but when they die, they're happy. You know, they not only fall in love, but they die for love, but they end up, and then everyone who dies ends up as happy as they possibly can be, you know, as does everybody who's alive. So it's... It was also to make a film about ghosts and the supernatural that was incredibly romantic, you know what I mean? That 'cause most movies about these issues are to do with, you know, death and decay and horror, and I've dealt with that myself, you know, so I wanted to treat ghosts as if they were the most kind of romantic creatures in the world, really.
You must have had to learn how to create a comic feeling, and I say that because there's certain even technical things that you have to do when you're doing a comedy that are different from what you do if you're doing a film noir. Building suspense and building comedy are slightly different, aren't they?
Well, it's terrible to do a comedy, actually. It's awful because if you do a thriller or if you do, you know, a tragic story, or nobody ever says, is it thrilling enough or is it tragic enough? You know, people... But with regard to a comedy, people say, well, is it funny enough? You know, I mean, is it... And so it kind of really has to work at one basic level. It's a terrifying thing to do. I find it quite terrifying.
Oh, and the response is measurable. You could go into a theatre and count laughs.
You kind of... Well, people do.
Yeah,
it's a terrible
thing.
You know, people play it in theatres and say, well, they didn't laugh between the 4th and the 56th minute, you know, so what's going on there? You know, and it's... There's a kind of a mechanical aspect to it, which is tough, I think, which is difficult.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Neil Jordan. He's a writer and film director. His new movie, High Spirits, stars Daryl Hannah, Steve Guttenberg, Beverly D'Angelo, and Peter O'Toole. Your previous films were largely funded by Channel 4, the independent television station in England. High Spirits is your first film to have a big budget and to come out of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. What were the basic differences between the options you had on this film and the options you had doing a more modestly funded film in the past?
Well, it's very simple. It comes down to one word. It comes down to freedom, really. If you do a modestly budgeted film, you basically, you know, you're free to shape it as you want. You know, you're free to, you know, die a disaster or, you know, make a masterpiece. When you make a, you know, when you need $12-14 million and you have to get American finance and you make a film that actually needs to play in a Broadway with a public audience, you involve yourself in a whole different kind of conversation, you know, which does mean, you know, a quite severe curtailing of one's, you know, certain kind of freedoms.
So it becomes a little less personal.
It becomes a little less personal. It becomes more an object of discussion between people at board around boardrooms. It becomes less yours, I would say. You know, it becomes more, you know, more a corporate thing and less a personal thing.
Is it worth the sacrifice?
Well, that's the I often think that films were given by, invented by a very, you know, kind of wicked God. You know, he gave us this great medium, you know, that you can achieve more than you could. He said we'll give to people this medium, you know, in which they can achieve more than they could ever possibly dream of, yeah? If they got the resources, yeah? So he said we'll give them this medium in which they can achieve all this stuff, but we'll only allow them to achieve, you know, 1/100 of its potential, really. And it's a battle. If you want to deal with certain subject matters, if you want to deal with special effects, if you want to deal with large events, if you want to deal with a large kind of visual canvas, it costs money, you know. So at a certain stage, one has to enter into that kind of battle, really.
I think the whole sense of casting becomes different when you're making a major motion picture, not only because you have greater access to actors, but you're almost compelled to hire name actors in order to have big names put on the marquee.
Well, you are and you are not, but they're very good, you know, they're very good actors, you know, that are stars and that names mean something in the marquee. Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, I thought we had a very interesting cast in this film, actually. Mm-hmm. There was a kind of a wonderful balance in the whole ensemble, which was a delight for me to work with, actually.
Peter O'Toole has such great oratory skills.
Yeah, he's great old theatrical kind of gentleman, isn't he?
Yeah, how did you try to use him in that context, given these great oratory skills that he has? I think he really took good advantage of that.
Yeah, well, we based the part, myself and Peter knew this. Peter is, you know, he's from Ireland and he knows the Irish theatrical lore. There was a wonderful old Irish actor called Anu McMaster, who used to run fit-up companies, in other words, you know, a travelling Shakespeare company in the 50s in Ireland. He was kind of a legend in his day, very theatrical, kind of ridiculous man. And Peter based his performance on that character, you know, basically. This kind of rather grand, passionate, oratorical human being.
You know, it's funny, Peter O'Toole, I think, had a reputation in the past for having an alcohol problem, which I think he overcame. And of course, in your movie, he plays an alcoholic, someone who's always drinking.
Yeah, well, no, Peter is in wonderful shape. He's, you know, very fit. You know, he's had a totally new lease of life. He's delightful to work with, and I'd love to work with him again. He was playing an alcoholic, you know, but of course he was just drinking water.
You're right.
Through the entire film.
Screenwriter and director Neil Jordan is my guest. His new movie is called High Spirits, and it's a supernatural comedy. I think until people see your new movie, you'll be best known for Mona Lisa, which is your film noir of a few years ago.
Yeah.
About a small-time hoodlum working in the sex trades. How much did you know about that world when you co-wrote and directed this movie?
I don't know. Everybody has an image, you know. Every man has a kind of an image of what a prostitute is like, you know. Everybody, you know, they know red light districts. They have a, you know, there's a kind of series of archetypes that film was dealing with that people know about, you know, they instinctively know about. But I did a lot of research, you know, when I was writing the script and when I was beginning to shape the movie and to design it. But it's kind of such a drab world, you know, that it's not that revealing at all. You know, I mean, one would go into these peep shows or meet these girls who were prostitutes and, you know, find a combination of broken homes and drug addiction. You know, kind of real kind of suburban sadness, really, which had led to, you know, led to the lives people were leading. And, you know, the reality of that kind of thing is not at all dramatic. And I must say, in the film, I shot it and composed it in a far more lurid way than the real kind of stories would lead one towards.
When you were meeting women who were prostitutes, what grounds did you use to meet them? Did you tell them you were doing research for a movie?
Yeah, they never believed me.
Sure, that must be the oldest line in history.
Yeah, absolutely. No. But I mean, you know, it's very interesting actually because. What I found, well, I wanted to cast quite a few girls who were like that in the movie, you know, and I did end up casting some of them in the smaller parts. Mm-hmm. But what one found was that one had to get through a tissue of lies, really, to begin to speak as a normal human being, you know, because most of the jobs of these girls, their daytime, you know, their kind of waking, working hours were involved with telling men, fat old men, lies, you know, telling fat old men that they like him, that they think they're sexy, they think they're attractive, they want to go to bed with them, do you understand what I mean?
Yeah.
So when they talked to me as a kind of a filmmaker, a man, they would also tell me lies, you know, so you have to go quite a long way before you actually begin to speak, you know, a kind of down-to-earth truth with people. But I met, it was very tough conditions, you know, very beautiful girls who were covered in track marks and, you know, one would know I was going to die within 4 weeks and stuff like that, you know, it's not a pleasant world.
Well, I want to play a scene from Mona Lisa. You had some really extraordinary actors in there, and two of the actors were Bob Hoskins and Michael Caine. Mm. And I want to just play an excerpt of a scene in which they act opposite each other. And Hoskins plays a small-time hoodlum who's hired to chauffeur a call girl around and keep tabs on her. And Hoskins' crime boss in the sex trade underworld is played by Michael Caine. Hoskins spent time in prison taking the rap for a crime committed by Caine. And here's a scene where they're meeting again.
You know what I think?
What do you think?
I think that you think I left you in the shit.
Well, you did, didn't you? Kind of.
Have a drink anyway, Jill. Life goes on happening. We can't control it. We can only swim in it.
Well, what happens when you can't swim?
You get water on the brain, George.
But that can't be good, Denny.
And do you know what happens then, George?
What happens?
You get confused, and always with the little things. You know the little things.
What little things?
Do you or do you not get confused?
Yeah, I'll get confused.
You still get confused?
Yes, I get confused.
Great. Well, at least now you know. You do know it, don't you, George?
All right, now I know.
Well, that's something.
Eh?
Because do you know what I'm good at, George?
What?
I'm good at the little things. The little things that mean everything.
There's so much in the rhythm in which they deliver their lines in that.
Yeah, that's a lovely speech, actually. You know, I enjoyed writing it. It's actually about nothing.
That's the thing.
It's great.
It almost reminded me of this is the wrong example to use, but it almost reminded me of Beckett, because the content, you know what I mean?
Well, what Michael Caine is saying to poor Bob is absolutely about nothing at all. You know?
Exactly.
All he wants to do is get him even more confused. You know, but they did it wonderfully. Yeah, I had forgotten that, actually.
Well, in directing that, I mean, you're working with these two great actors who both have fabulous voices and just incredible delivery. What was your role as a director in creating this interaction between them?
Well, that was a complicated scene because there were 200 dancing girls kind of rehearsing this drab sex routine behind them when they were saying it. Don't you remember?
Yeah, we heard a little bit of that stomping around
them. Yeah, stomping. That's these kind of Germanic ladies, you know, with the high boots and kind of straps and all that sort of stuff. I don't know, really. It's to get a sense of the character. It's also to get a sense of the broader scene, you know? I mean, to bring out through both of the actors all of the levels of meaning that would be possible within that scene, you know? On the one hand, it's a scene of a hoodlum going back to his boss and asking for a job and for some money that he owes him. On the other hand, it's a boss kind of trying to say to the hoodlum without... trying to admit it that he doesn't want him anymore. Do you understand? And on the other hand, it's these two old mates, one of whom is saying, "Well, look at me now. I'm far bigger than you ever could be." You know. And on the last thing is it's the Michael Caine character expressing kind of sense of utter negativity and nonsense about what his life is about and about his vision of the world. You know. That's so. It's kind of somewhere in between all of those things, the scene exists, you know, it's a matter of finding that.
Now, is it easier to use that kind of language that isn't saying anything in particular to get at that larger meaning in a movie than it is in, if that dialogue were in a novel?
Well, the great thing about, because there's rhythms in dialogue that kind of only exist when you hear them.
Exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you read Hemingway, he uses short, cryptic lines, but if you actually try and translate those to the stage or to the screen, they actually don't work. I had an interesting experience a few years ago. I was adapting a novel by Dashiell Hammett called Red Harvest into a screenplay, which was never made, and I was trying to use Hammett's dialogue, which on the surface of it seems great, but when I would put it on the page to be read dramatically, you know, it fell to pieces. And the only way I could actually compose the screenplay was to pull from his narrative description and make that dialogue. Do you understand what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite a different thing, I think, spoken speech. I'm glad you're asking me this, actually. Most people don't even think about these things.
Well, do you find yourself saying your lines out loud when you're writing for the movies to hear how they actually sound when spoken?
Well, you've got two things when you're writing for the movies. First of all, you're inventing the character, and that comes from nowhere. It comes from what the character is. And second of all, you're using kind of modes of speech that are in some way movie language. Even if it's a British thriller and a British film noir, do you understand what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You're still using, there's a kind of a crop of phrases and common phrases that, and modes of speech that one can use as cliches and as remade cliches and as kind of, you know, things that have a rhythm of their own and a life of their own. So there's two elements one can deal with, particularly in a film noir, you know, particularly in a story that is about crime and about hoodlums and about, you know, the underworld and stuff like that.
One other question I wanted to ask you about Mona Lisa. You cast Michael Caine in really a very small role in that movie.
Mm.
And he's a bad guy as well. He's a villainous character. Someone in the underworld who takes advantage of people who are less smart than he is, who are his underlings in the underworld. And it was really one of the best roles I've seen him in years, even in spite of the fact that it was really a small role. Was it hard to convince him to do that? And what made you think of him for that role?
Well,
usually he's the leading man.
It's very difficult to convince him to do that, you know. I mean, it's he did it because he liked the script, he liked Bob Hoskins, he liked myself, he liked Handmade Films, the company that was making the that was producing it. And he did it because we could squeeze all of his scenes into 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you have to do with actors of that, you know, that stature. You have to get the time frame as small as possible, you know, and get them in and out as quick as you can. But he, I mean, he's a great actor, Michael. He was wonderful in Hannah and Her Sisters, I thought.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, he's every now and then he does something magnificent, and then he does a lot of stuff that is not that good, you know. But it's generally the films that aren't good, while he remains above them, you know.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk with you more about your movies, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is writer and film director Neil Jordan. His new film, High Spirits, stars Daryl Hannah, Steve Guttenberg, and Beverly D'Angelo, as well as Peter O'Toole. It's a supernatural comedy. His other films are Mona Lisa, Company of Wolves, and Danny Boy. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer and film director Neil Jordan is my guest. You started off writing novels before you started making movies.
Yeah.
Why did you want to switch from books to films?
I don't know. I think every writer nowadays is obsessed with filmmaking, you know, with films and with the possibility of film as a expressive medium. I mean, every novelist that I talk to kind of has such a strange dual kind of, you know, attitude towards what I do. And towards what filmmakers do, they, on the one hand, they regard it as, you know, a medium that just corrupts their books if they're ever made into movies. But on the other hand, they see the power of the medium, and they feel lonely that they're outside of it, you know? I mean, it always affected me. It affected the kind of writing I was doing, the kind of prose I was writing. Films were a very strong influence even on the fiction that I was doing, you know? And it seemed a natural thing to want to write a film script, and having written a film script, it seemed a natural thing to want to make a film. You know, it just seemed a natural progression for me. I had a theatre group at the same time in Dublin, and so had, you know, some acquaintance with stage design and directing of actors and things like that.
Do you have a dual attitude yourself about your love of movies and having left, at least temporarily, writing books? I'm thinking that, you know, hey, if everybody felt that way, who'd be writing books? You know, do you ever feel like, oh, I'm betraying literature by turning my back on it and working for movies?
I felt that very strongly, actually, years ago, because in Ireland, it's a very literary culture, you know, and I was quite well known as a writer, and I was being hailed as the, you know, the new emerging voice, you know, who would do serious things with fiction and would be, you know, was there to be nurtured and all that sort of stuff. When I began to make films, all the older generation of writers felt quite betrayed, you know, quite angry. They felt it was not something that a serious writer should indulge in.
Well, there really hasn't been much of a film industry in Ireland.
No.
Where did you turn when you decided you wanted to make movies?
There's a filmmaker called John Borman who lived next door to me. He lives up the in the Wicklow Hills, you know, and he read some of the scripts. He read my books. He read some of the scripts I've been doing and asked me to work with him on several things. So that was really, he did a film called Excalibur for which I wrote part of the script, and I did a documentary about him making it, and that was the only school I had, really, you know.
Well, you took one of your screenplays for what in this country is called Danny Boy, what in England and Ireland, I think, was called Angel.
Yeah.
You took that to Channel 4, which is the independent, reasonably new independent television station in England that's been funding a lot of movies. And they funded your first screenplay. And they let you direct it as well, which I think is a pretty...
extraordinary.
Yeah, pretty risky thing for them to have done. You had absolutely no experience directing.
Absolutely. None whatsoever. But sometimes that's... that can be a fresh thing, you know, because, I mean, I did not know anything about, you know, the normal ways in which motion pictures are shot. I didn't know about complementary close-ups, the idea of coverage. I didn't even know what it was, you know. All I knew was the script that I had and what I wanted to see on the screen. You know, so I would shoot... I just shot the film exactly as I wanted to see it on the screen. And... sometimes actors would get quite annoyed, you know, if I would play a scene off them, you know, and I wouldn't even cover their aspect of it, you know, and they say, well, why aren't you doing a shot of me? And I say, well, I don't think we need it, really. I just wanted to do this bit, you know. So the editor had very little to work with, and there was only one way to put the film together, which led to certain kind of jaggedness in the cutting of it. But, you know, it leads to, I think, quite a bit of freshness and...
You've shot at least two of your movies that I know of in Ireland, the new movie High Spirits and your first movie, Danny Boy. There aren't many movies that are shot in Ireland. Were the neighborhoods in which you were doing location shooting prepared for what it was going to mean to shoot there?
Well, there's quite a lot of television work goes on there. There's quite a lot of small films goes on there. There's quite a lot of international productions that come in to do, you know, location work there and things like that. So there's a kind of an industry there, you know, but that's almost like a service industry. So, you know, for one who wants to make a film there, there's a lot of backup and there's good crews and all that sort of stuff. I didn't have any problems like that.
Why is there so small a film industry in Ireland now?
Because it's a very poor country, basically. That's the... beginning and the end of it, you know. There's, you know, in some areas of Dublin, there's 40-50% unemployment, and you know, if there's a, you know, a continuing kind of conflict up the north of Ireland, and I suppose the government have other things to think about than putting money into film, which is a pity.
Is that part of the reason why you're trying to shoot films there?
Well, I live there, you see, and I want to continue to live there.
You still do live there?
Oh yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's, you know, you can't leave your language and your culture, and you can't leave the things that. You know, that inform your heart, that inform your instincts, you know. You can't abandon them. So I'd say the most interesting films I would make would be about Ireland and set there, you know. As well as that, at the moment I'm, you know, I'm making larger, more expensive films that with, you know, that are with American finance and for studios and things like that. And I think I want to make it always possible for myself to make smaller and cheaper films, you know, with the kind of freedom that you have doing those.
Mm-hmm. In your film Danny Boy, it's about a saxophonist who witnesses two murders outside of a club where he's playing, and there it's an underworld murder, and that sets the film in action. You were a musician yourself, right? You played
saxophone? Yeah, that film was based on an incident that happened in the north of Ireland. I used to play with, I used to play saxophone with what would be called a show band, a kind of a dance band, and we used to travel. In the conflict in the north of Ireland, musicians were traditionally immune. You know, they would be able to travel all around the north of Ireland, down the south, and there was a kind of an interplay between the music community that wasn't, you know, that wasn't allowed in other communities. You know, and at one stage, a bunch of, I think it was 12 musicians were taken out of a van and machine gunned and killed. That was what sparked the incident in my mind. You know,
and that really shook you up and ended up.
Yeah, well, it's a horrific thing when you see. I mean, one thing's that music is to do with pleasure and light, and you know, bringing pleasure to people's lives, and as being a basically harmless kind of activity, you know. And when you think of a guitar player and a bass player and a drummer, you know, just being taken out and shot because of what they, you know, where they were born, it's you know, it's a very shocking image, and it also put into my mind a film about death, about, you know, political death. That was, you know, that allowed you the contrast of everything that music means, you know. So I kind of tried to shoot it almost like a musical, you know, in terms of the color and the, you know, the design and the lights and things like that. It was a very dark story, but shot with this odd sense of fantasy to it.
I ask you this because most of your films have been dark, but your new film is a comedy. Do you see your own life as being mostly a drama, tragedy, or comedy?
comedy.
You do?
But a very bad one, you know, very, kind of a farce, I would say, really. It's a bedroom farce, I would say.
would you explain?
No, I can't. It's too personal.
Okay. Your next film is going to be a remake?
Yeah, my next film is a film called We're No Angels, which is a script written by David Mamet.
Oh, great.
And it's for Robert De Niro and Sean Penn. It's a period film set in 1935.
I find it really interesting that you'll be working with De Niro and Penn. I think they're both extraordinary actors, but also Penn seems to, in some ways, have modeled himself on De Niro.
There's a mutual fascination there, I think, you know. It is mutual, actually. It's
between those two actors?
Between both, yeah, it is. Yeah.
What's the basis of that fascination?
I think it's the tradition of acting they both come out of, really. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a thing you don't find anywhere else in the world. This that particular style of film acting, I find it fascinating, you know.
Which style?
I don't know what you'd call it. I mean, I don't want to call it the method because that seems to denigrate it, really. It's the it's a thing that I suppose comes from Lee Strasberg to Marlon Brando to Robert De Niro, you know, to quite a few younger actors now. It's quite unique. I think it's a unique contribution to the state of acting that American cinema has given. It's you don't find the kind of intensity you got from Robert De Niro and figures like that anywhere in, you know, in any other film culture, I think.
This will be the first movie that you direct that you haven't written, or at
yes.
least co-written.
Absolutely, yeah.
Are you? I mean, how do you feel about that? I'm sure you like to direct.
Well, it's a relief. It's a relief not to be criticizing your own work. You know what I mean? Not to have to be saying who wrote this stuff anyway. You know what I mean?
You have to take responsibility.
I can't blame myself anymore. You know, It's an odd position, actually, for me to be in, because every film I've done before, I've really done it because I've written it, you know what I mean? I've said,
right,
this is the story I want to tell, you know, right. This is the way I want to tell it, and I've spoken to the actors on that basis. This is quite unusual, you know, it's fascinating for me, really.
Well, I wish you good luck with it. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Neil Jordan's new film, High Spirits, is a supernatural comedy that opens this weekend. It stars Daryl Hannah, Steve Guttenberg, Beverly D'Angelo, and Peter O'Toole. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be Nicholas Coleridge. His new book, The Fashion Conspiracy, looks at the many different facets of the fashion world. He attended lavish high society parties where designer originals are worn, and he secretly visited a Korean sweatshop where the clothes are made. He also looks into the cozy relationship between the designers and the fashion press. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In the last 36 years, TV talk show host Joe Franklin has interviewed a lot of stars on their way up and a lot of stars on their way down. He's proud his show isn't slick, and he's glad Billy Crystal used to parody him on Saturday Night Live. Coming up, we meet a talk show institution. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new albums from a pair of British groups, the Pet Shop Boys and Eighth Wonder. And film critic Stephen Schiff judges how the band U2's rock and roll holds up on the big screen. Stephen reviews their new concert movie, Rattle and Hum. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. As expected, President-elect Bush named outgoing New Hampshire Governor John Sununu to be his White House chief of staff. Bush also said his campaign manager, Lee Atwater, is his choice for chairman of the Republican National Committee. NPR's Jim Angle has more.
He's the right man for the job, Bush said. He's a take-charge kind of guy, and I'm close to him personally. Sununu is a Washington outsider with relatively little political experience. He's finishing his third term as governor of New Hampshire, but spent most of his life as an engineer and a college professor. Though Sununu, who must run the White House and manage relations with Congress, has little Washington experience, Bush pointed to his position as head of the National Governors Association and as chairman of the Republican Governors Association. Bush cited as well his work as a community leader and college professor.
And that experience will bring to my administration a refreshing new perspective that, in my view, is critical to help move our country forward.
In choosing Sununu, Bush passed over his current chief of staff, Craig Fuller, who said today he will leave public life in January. Sununu has been criticized as being a little brusque and hot-headed. He smiled when asked about that today and said, "I'm a pussycat." I'm Jim Angle in Washington.
The State Department says it has ordered the expulsion of an Iraqi diplomat from the U.S. in retaliation for what it says is Iraq's unjustified expulsion of a U.S. diplomat from Baghdad. A State Department spokesman said Iraq's expulsion of the American will have an adverse impact on U.S.-Israeli, or rather U.S.-Iraqi relations. President Reagan today called on Canadians to embrace the free trade agreement between the U.S. and Canada. The pact, which eliminates most trade barriers between the two countries, has become a major issue in the Canadian election being held Monday. And with his words today, President Reagan injected himself into the middle of that contest. We have two reports, the first from NPR's John Idstey.
Canadian Liberal leader John Turner has vowed to tear up the trade pact if his party takes power. And his promise has propelled him into a dead heat with Conservative Prime Minister Brian Mulroney. The pact is an issue because many Canadians fear it would bring economic domination by the United States. But today, President Reagan praised the agreement and said the future belongs to those who lower trade barriers.
It comes down to this. Every time countries, any place in the world, have taken a step together toward freer trade, the results were just what was expected. More productive and competitive economies, more jobs, and greater benefits for the citizens of each country.
Defeat of the trade pact would be a deep disappointment for Reagan, who has championed free trade during the past 8 years. I'm John Idstey in Washington.
From Toronto now, Richard Reynolds reports that the president's speech today brought immediate charges of interference from the leader of Canada's Liberal Party.
Free trade is the dominant issue in the Canadian election. The overwhelming choice that Canadians will be making when they vote on Monday is between Prime Minister Brian Mulroney's Conservative Party, which stands behind the free trade pact it negotiated with Washington, and Canada's other two political parties, which have promised to tear up the deal. Even though Reagan's speech was considered by many analysts to be very low-key, Liberal leader John Turner still wasn't pleased and even suggested that the speech had been written in Ottawa.
No one can deny that that's a major intervention. And that what I'm saying is not anti-American at all. I am intensely surprised that Mr. Mulroney would resort to this type of support from the president.
Turner also couldn't help adding a partisan jibe, saying that the lame duck Reagan was doing his best to help his friend, the dead duck Mulroney. For National Public Radio, I'm Richard Reynolds in Toronto.
On Wall Street, the Dow Industrial Average closed up almost 14 points. You're listening to NPR and...
This is Fresh Air. Two rock groups from England, the Pet Shop Boys and Eighth Wonder, have new albums out. Rock critic Ken Tucker says they're both characterized by an understated, witty edge.
I was faced with a choice at a difficult age. Would I write a book or should I take to the stage? But in the back of my head, I heard distant feet, Che Guevara and Debussy to a disco beat.
No act in current popular music is as amusingly self-conscious as the English duo that calls itself the Pet Shop Boys. They've even entitled their new album Introspective. The boys are Chris Lowe and Neil Tennant, and they've become stars, medium-sized stars in America, big ones in England, by exploiting the pleasures of superficiality.
I want to talk.
That's I Want a Dog. The Pet Shop Boys are absolutely insistent on keeping everything about their music small scale. The melodies are tight little repetitive things. The lyrics are thin declarative sentences. Even the dog the singer wants is small, a chihuahua. The Pet Shop Boys don't so much remind you of other pop acts as much as they do a certain foppish, put-on style of English literature. You can imagine the young Evelyn Waugh cradling that chihuahua in the crook of his arm, or Ronald Furbank giving it a gingerly stroke. But it's not as if all this is entirely English, either. The boys borrow some of their rhythm from a neighboring continent, the steady pulse that used to be called Euro Disco. They also scavenge from American rock and pop as well. One of the Pet Shop Boys' biggest hits last year was an ironic version of Always On My Mind, an American song made famous by a variety of performers, including Elvis Presley.
Maybe
that's a version of Always On My Mind so chilly, so resolutely distanced from the emotion stated in the lyric, that at first it's difficult to recognize it as the pop ballad Elvis used to croon so sincerely. Yet at the same time, it's a version that the King might have approved of. In its crisp, precise way, the Pet Shop Boys' music is very much a throwback to an earlier generation of pop. The British critic Simon Frith has expressed extravagant admiration for the Pet Shop Boys, while referring to them as, quote, just another British pop group, showroom dummies with electronic equipment and a memory bank of old disco riffs. The idea is that they offer an interesting contrast to the overblown earnestness and self-importance that dominates so much American rock. Their very ambivalence adds an intriguing layer of meaning to the music. The same might be said of Eighth Wonder, another English act, this one led by lead singer Patsy Kensit. Kensit doesn't write the music or produce the songs, but her serene coo is this act's characteristic sound.
I'm
The emotional standoffishness of this music makes Eighth Wonder very similar in its anonymous effects to the Pet Shop Boys, even if Patsy Kensett's prominence as an actress has lent her band more of a personality than the Pet Shop Boys. Kensett became a star in England for her performance in the movie Absolute Beginners. Over here, the movie was a bomb, and Kensett is virtually unknown. That may change, however, if American radio picks up on the group's new album Fearless. It's the first release by a new record company, WTG Records, distributed by the huge conglomerate CBS. This is the sort of act a major company can really get behind. Eighth Wonder's music screams commercialism with a proud insistence, and for all its knowingness, much of it is irresistible. As if to make their common ground explicit, the Pet Shop Boys have written a song for Eighth Wonder on this album called I'm Not Scared. Your life's a mystery. Pet Shop Boys have included their version of I'm Not Scared on their own album, Introspective. Sometimes I find the idea of the Pet Shop Boys more intriguing than the music they make, but so far, the music of Eighth Wonder combines cerebral and emotional pleasures for maximum fun.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's some more music from Eighth Wonder's new album, Fearless. This is Fresh Air.
As we say good morning, we bring you glad tidings. We try and be kind of an antidote to the, stress and the pressure and the sour news, and we try and give you a happy show, an upbeat show. Now, talking about happy, it might be fun to see a couple of your favorite comedians as they appeared on this program, I would say, in the 1950s. I'm going to show you Jackie Mason and Woody Allen, past tense, as they looked when these photographs were left in my studio. I would say about 1958, 59, maybe 1960. Jackie Mason as a young comedian, and all we can say
that's TV and radio talk show host Joe Franklin. He's seen on more than 2,500 cable stations every night. But until 6 years ago, he was solely a New York institution, an institution that dates back continuously to 1952, making him TV's most long-lasting talk show host. He's also the last of a breed. He's proud of being unpolished and without big production values, playing host to has-beens, never-will-bes, and showbiz greats he so admires. In a 1971 profile in the New Yorker magazine, William Whitworth wrote, "However interesting Joe's show may be, many of Joe's friends feel that the way to seek exposure to his magic is not by watching his show, but by visiting his office. Joe's office is even less like other offices than his television show is like other television shows. It has a quality that goes beyond mere grime and disorder. If it were a person, it would be a bum." We invited Joe Franklin to take a short break from his celebrated office and go crosstown to the NPR studios. We talked first about the parodies of the Joe Franklin show that Billy Crystal used to do on Saturday Night Live. I asked Franklin if he thought it was a good parody.
I never could see it because I was on the radio opposite Billy. I do an all-night radio show. I was on opposite Saturday Night Live. So finally, one day, somebody showed me a videotape of Billy Crystal doing Joe Franklin. And when I looked at it, you want to know what I said?
What'd you say?
I said, one of us is lousy. but he did make me into a cult figure or a superstar. And I've got a little crusade going now to try and get Billy Crystal back on Saturday Night Live, because I missed that weekly. I mean, that was a tremendous plug. And I've got a letter writing crusade and people calling up NBC. We're trying to get him back on that show so we can do more of. I know he's making movies, but his heart is really, I know, with those comedy sketches and doing me. And I wish he'd get back and do more of me.
You know, here's something I'd wonder about, though. Did you ever ask yourself, when you were getting a lot of response when Billy Crystal was on, how many of the people who were writing you were doing it ironically and how many were, like, really sincerely liked your show? Do you know what I mean?
They all like me. It's done with affection. I'll tell you one thing. People who are doing a spoof on me, they're doing a spoof on a spoof. Because as you can probably gather by now, I'm putting the whole world on. My whole existence is kind of tongue-in-cheek.
Well, what do you mean by that you're putting the world on?
People think that they're using me. I'm using them better. When Billy Crystal does me, he's doing me the favor.
Uh-huh.
I have maybe 6 letters from Billy Crystal and from his press agent asking to put him on my TV show. I don't want him on there. I've turned him down for a funny reason, Terry.
Why would you turn him down?
Well,
hey, we've been trying to get him on our show.
Let me tell you. Well, no, he'd be good for your show. And I would imagine, see, you know, Woody Allen. It was either Woody Allen or Dick Cavett. I forget which one. They told me once how they worshipped and idolized Groucho Marx, almost as a divinity. They worshipped Groucho Marx. They couldn't wait for the day when they could get Groucho Marx on their program. So they finally, after many years of negotiating and begging and pleading, they got Groucho Marx on the show. And they were totally, totally disillusioned. They found out after they met him, nose to nose, eyeball to eyeball on the mic or on the camera, that he was just like anybody else's grandfather, an ordinary, nice, smiling man, but not that brittle, sarcastic wit that he was in the movies. So I figure if Billy Crystal meets me in person, maybe it's an inferiority on my part. I feel he'd be disillusioned or disenchanted. He'd find out that I'm not that wonderful character that he makes me out to be, and he might just become non-enchanted and stop doing me. So I figure let him admire me from afar, let him adore me from afar, and not come on my show and not meet me. Leave well enough alone.
You are famous for some of the most generous introductions to your guests. Do you think of it as a courtesy to flatter a guest after you've invited them on?
I make them feel good. I give them a build-up, ladies and gentlemen, the one, the only. This party is getting rave reviews, critical acclaim, accolades. And then I would say 7 times out of 10 they deserve it. 3 times out of 10 they don't. But if we book them onto the show, we like to make them feel good. You know, people kid about me, or I can turn on the radio late at night and I hear people talking about Joe Franklin, what a nice guy he is. He puts everybody on TV, but you got to realize that it's not so. For everybody who's on the show, there's about 1,000 I've got to turn down.
You have met a lot of people on their way up, and you've met a lot of people on their way down.
Right.
Who are some of the people who are now stars who you gave early exposure to on your show?
Whether it was a talk show or a variety show or any TV screen, I gave the first exposure ever to people such as Barbara Streisand, Woody Allen, Flip Wilson, Bette Midler, Liza Minnelli, Michael Jackson when he was with the family, Bruce Springsteen, who's been on me about 5 times.
Do they remember you after they're stars?
A few come back. Bill Cosby comes back. Most don't come back because I represent. See, when they see me, they think of the days when they were broke, and they feel a little bit embarrassed. I guess that's human nature. I mean, it's kind of shallow, I guess, but it is human nature that I tend to represent the time when they were broke, and they'd rather avoid me. A few come back, but most of them duck on the other side of the street when they see me.
Now, you've been on the air long enough, over 36 years, that you've seen some of the same people on their way up and on their way down.
Right.
So, you know, I'm sure you probably get some of them after when they're making their comeback after the cocaine or alcohol crisis.
And you want to know something?
What?
I very happily put them on.
Sure.
I hold no grudges. Sure. I always kid about what you just said, Terry. I always say that I feature those on the way up and on the way down. So, you know, listen, who's to knock that, right? It's not a business anymore where big names make the show. It's a business now of conversational themes and formats. It's not a question anymore that Bob Hope or George Burns is going to get you a big rating. Today it's just a question of what are you talking about? Is it kinky? Is it going to make a little bit of excitement? And how far can you go in this era of tabloid TV?
When someone calls, you say that they frequently talk to you directly. That means that you're the one who has to tell them no if you're going to turn someone down who wants to be a guest.
Well, I try to let them down gently. That's also a good point. I just hate to say no. I try to recommend them to a cable show or to a lesser show or to somebody who can use that kind of a guest. But
you've been in this business so long. Why can't you say no?
I'm just nice. I mean,
you turn people down, but I mean, why can't you just come out and say nah?
And that's one of my weaknesses. That's one of my sadnesses. I don't know how to say no. I used to travel with Jimmy Durante a lot. Jimmy was a good friend. Remember the name Jimmy Durante?
Oh, sure.
Schnozzola.
Sure.
And I'd walk with him in the street, and people would walk up to him and say, Jimmy, can you come to my church on Saturday night and do a show? Can you come to my house Sunday and have lunch? And he would say, yeah, 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 to everybody. And then, of course, when Saturday night came, he couldn't make it because he was booked for an engagement or for a Colgate comedy hour. And so I guess it kind of rubbed off on me. I'm just nice. That's the answer, nice. And I know it backfires, and people sometimes hate me for it, but...
Do you accept invitations and not show up, like
always,
Jimmy Durante?
I'm due every night in 15 different places. And I don't even call to cancel a reservation. But listen, life goes on, right?
But do you think people should know better than to ask you in the first place?
Well, most people know by now. They know by now. And I always tell them, call back Monday morning at 9 o'clock, because I won't be there Monday morning at 9 o'clock. So I just haven't got the heart to say no.
Television and radio are usually considered professions for gypsies because you have to move around so much from station to station. And you've stayed put for a really long time. As a matter of fact, you're in the Guinness Book of Records now for having the longest-running talk show.
And the most interviews.
Oh, you have two entries?
Yeah, two entries. About 180,000 guests and maybe 28,000 times it has said on the TV screen, The Joe Franklin Show.
How long are you planning on doing your show?
I would say until the end of 1989.
Okay, but you know, that really surprises me because you're national now. You've become very famous in the past few years. You have listeners viewers all around the country. It seems like the opposite time. I'd expect you to retire.
I'd rather quit before I get evicted. I'd rather phase out gently. Just a question now of there's not much left to do or say. I've done most of it, you know?
You don't think you'll miss being on the air every day?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I've done it, and anybody who tries to equal my record would have to probably start now and still be on the air about the year 2028 or 2037, which I don't think could happen in today's fickle day and age.
What's the worst dream you've had, nightmare dream, about your show? Everybody, I think, who hosts radio or TV shows has had a few really bad dreams.
Being late for the studio, couldn't get a taxi, couldn't get a cab, and being late, and but even then when I wake up, I say, so what if I was late? The world goes on, you know, you can't worry about each and every show, can't worry about perfection, there is no perfection, I just roll with the punches.
Joe Franklin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, I've enjoyed it. Please invite me back and come on my show whenever you're ready. I'm on WOR Radio weekends. You know about that.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
The Joe Franklin Show is seen on WWOR-TV. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Renee Montaigne. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, one of our top stories tonight is the results of the election in Pakistan. The party of Benazir Bhutto has taken nearly half the seats in parliament, which means that Ms. Bhutto will become Pakistan's first woman prime minister. Also, the Kremlin has summoned the leaders of Estonia to Moscow a day after the Baltic Republic declared its sovereignty to emphasize, according to news reports, that the Kremlin has serious misgivings about the constitutionality of Estonia's move. And we talked to the author of an unusual cookbook. It's called Unmentionable Cuisine. The title tells it all, Terry. There are recipes for chocolate rabbit, red ant chutney, and baked bat.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Irish rock group U2 is one of the most successful and popular bands around, but film critic Stephen Schiff says in their new concert film Rattle and Hum, Bono and the guys take it all a bit too seriously.
The kindest thing I can say about the U2 concert film is that it gets less noxious as it goes along. But how could it get worse? In the first few minutes, we watch the boys preening in their Dublin studio. We watch the documentary's callow young director, Phil Juano, asking them callow young questions, to which they respond with the usual rock star giggles. And then we watch the earth-shaking greatness that is U2 descend upon America. The band's attitude toward this country is something like the attitude of a prosperous contemporary tourist visiting the ruins of Greece. The boys go slumming in Harlem, play with a gospel choir, and listen wonderingly to a black street musician. And all the while, they seem to be nodding sagely and saying, "And to think that there was once a great civilization here, a civilization whose rock and roll was almost as advanced as our own." When the boys sit on the banks of the Mississippi or visit Graceland, the movie dotes on their every Neanderthal observation. It's as though we were watching Stravinsky visit Mozart's birthplace. What goes through the inconceivably powerful mind of a giant like Bono at a time like this? Admittedly, I've never been a big fan of pretentio rock. What I see and hear when I watch U2 is somewhat underwhelming. A competent but not very rhythmic rhythm section that steals what little thunder it has from The Who, and that wouldn't know a soulful backbeat or a tasty R&B groove if it tripped over them. I always find it hilarious to hear Bono exhorting them to play the blues. Then there's The Edge, a fine rhythm guitarist, somewhat miscast as a lead player. He's at his best when he's borrowing arpeggiated harmonics from The Birds or The Who. And finally, there's the great god Bono himself, bending and gesticulating and flinging his dingy locks in exaltation. Bono is like a Jim Morrison you can bring home to mom. He has the same air of self-importance, the same confidence that if he tells us war is bad or people shouldn't kill each other, he said something profound and affecting. He even has much the same voice, a chesty mumble that then leaps an octave to become a thick, throaty blare. But when B.B. King comes on stage in the movie to join the band, the richness of his voice makes Bono's croonings sound adolescent and tinny, and the melodic beauty of his guitar playing exposes the band's thudding and thundering for the soulless posturing it is. Rattle and Hum has lovely black-and-white cinematography, but as a film it's a mess. The movie makes the mistake of trying to turn an American concert tour into some sort of pilgrimage, or, as one band member insists, a musical journey. You feel unnerved watching scene after scene of U2 singing old Jimi Hendrix songs, playing with the Memphis horns, and generally paying tribute to an American rock and roll past that they seem to know little or nothing about. These guys can tour America all they want, but they still haven't found what I'm looking for.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with an actor who's played his share of psychopaths, Brad Dourif. He's appeared in the films The Eyes of Laura Mars, Blue Velvet, and Wise Blood. And he also played Billy Bibbit, the stutterer, in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. His latest role is in the thriller Child's Play. Our performer in residence, pianist Harry Connick Jr., returns with a Cole Porter tune and a song by Matt Dennis. And critic Ken Tucker reviews the video Cover Up. It's a documentary alleging that a so-called shadow government has been operating in the United States, involved in drug smuggling and other shady dealings. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.